Live from Houston, Texas, the humidity capital of the world, it's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
And we're going to be talking to Mr. Bill Bartman. Bill Bartman is a highly recognized and awarded businessman, and he's got a very interesting story. I want you guys to listen to this. Bill, welcome to the show.
Well, Bert, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Bill, I know a lot of our listeners may not have heard your story, so before we get into it, and we're going to be talking about how to get out of credit card debt quickly, but before we get to that, give us a little bit about your background, a little bit about your story.
Well, certainly, and I guess we could start with the old standard rags to riches, but everybody's heard those stories so many times, they're almost like chopped liver anymore. So we don't call mine rags to riches, more like rats to riches. We grew up in a neighborhood where there were more rats per capita than there were people. But from there, fortunately, even though I was a high school dropout, spent 5.5 years in high school, an alcoholic by the time I was 17, I'm essentially deaf and wear hearing aids to hear about half of what goes on around about me, and grew up on welfare and poverty, and left home when I was 14, I managed to finally get my boat righted, as they would call it, and honestly, Bert, it happened because I met the woman of my life, the lady I met when I was 14, and she was 11. We dated for 10 years, and we've been married now for 36, and I give her all the credit in the world for kicking my rump, so to speak, back to the system. I got a GED. With my GED, I managed to get into college on probation, graduated on probation 4 years later, got into law school on probation, flunked out, got back in, finally graduated on probation, and with that, we're, Kathy and I have, over the course of our life, we've been blessed and fortunate that we've been able to have some pretty significant business success. In 1986, we went broke. I live in Oklahoma, and we were in the oil and gas business, and the price of oil went from $40 a barrel down to $14, and we went flat, bankrupt, broke, and from there we saw an opportunity, the same opportunity that's going on right now. We saw the economy being in the tank. We saw massive numbers of people being unemployed and banks failing, and so we started buying bad debt. We started buying charged-off credit cards for literally a nickel on the dollar, and with that, over the next 12 years, we created a billion-dollar company. Kathy and I became the 25th wealthiest people in America, members of the Forbes 400, and fortunately, we have won a whole list of business awards, none of which will buy you a cup of coffee anywhere, but they're real pretty when they hang on the wall.
Well, you know, it's good to be recognized by your peers. I think it does say a little bit, but you're right. When it comes down to it, it doesn't buy a cup of coffee. So tell us, Bill, you went from literally from rats to riches, as you like to say. You've been married to Kathy for 36 years?
36, yeah, which means she had to get a Purple Heart or something.
That's right. Well, you know, I think it's kind of cool that you give her all the credit. That is an amazing thing how women can affect us.
Oh, absolutely, Bert. You know, and it's so understated. I mean, you know, the old adage of behind every successful man, there's a woman. Well, that is so much baloney. Kathy has never been behind me. She's never been in front of me. She's always been alongside of me. And people who have great relationships, those are the ones who more often than not are the ones who are great successes in life. So isn't there a lesson there? You know, get a relationship, keep a relationship, work a relationship, and then maybe the rest of your life will fall in place.
Well, absolutely. It's very difficult to have success outside if you're not having success inside the home.
Oh, amen. Absolutely.
All right, well, let's get to it. Tell us about how to get out of credit card debt quickly.
Well, here is the quickest way possible, and it kind of rubs against the norm, and I don't want people to think I'm preaching some kind of financial anarchy or something when I tell them that, but remember now, the business that we created was buying charged-off credit cards, and we bought 4.5 million individual accounts, so I have some background here. What I'm suggesting, for people who are so far underwater that they can't see out, and, you know, that has a different definition for different people, but if you look at your own finances and say, at the job I have right now, at the way things are going, I am so far in. It doesn't matter how you got there. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. But if that's where you're at, you have to look at some pretty extraordinary situations to get out of the hole you're in. And one of the things you can do is, and here it comes, quit paying credit card bills. Now, when you quit paying your credit card bills, it will hurt your credit rating. Oh, boy, there it is almost an immediate thing. But the truth of the matter is, Bert, if somebody's that far upside down, they already have already hurt their own credit rating. And so one more little ding on it isn't probably going to make a big difference to them. Now, conversely, if your credit is good, you'd never want to do this. But if your credit's already been shot, if you quit paying your credit card bills, here's what happens. And you'll get some phone calls, you'll get collectors calling you, but if you just keep saying no, after 180 days, the credit card company, the bank, has to charge off the debt. That's a rule. That's a law, actually. That's a GAAP accounting rule. And the bank will charge off the debt and then sells those loans, those credit card debts, for as low as a nickel on the dollar to people like me. And when we buy them for a nickel on the dollar, we call up the same customer and we're prepared to settle for, you know, 15 cents on the dollar. So a person who is, say, $10,000 in debt on their credit card right now and can't pay the 10 grand because they just don't have it, they might be able to settle with somebody for, say, $1,500. And the problem is the bank won't let them settle with the bank for $1,500. So that's the one thing they can do is nothing. Don't pay your bills. And if you don't pay your bills, eventually they will be sold off to someone else who will settle with you for pennies on the dollar.
Well, that's a great strategy. It's kind of like reverse leverage.
It is exactly that. You know, it's kind of the one step short of bankruptcy. You know, when you file bankruptcy because you're so far in you can't get back out, you know you're going to hurt your credit, but you also know you're going to effectuate a solution. You know you're going to make a whole bunch of that junk go away. Well, this is a half step. Now, it's certainly right in line with going bankrupt because it's heading down that path, but it may be the one thing that keeps you from filing bankruptcy. And it would be better to have one or two creditors messing up your credit score as wiping out all of them.
Right. Typically, bankruptcy, and I know the bankruptcy law has changed and maybe you don't know the answer, but typically bankruptcy tends to stay on your credit for, what is it now, 7 or 10 years?
It is as long as 10 years that it will continue to show up or haunt you, as they say. And yes, I'm familiar with that. In 1986, we filed bankruptcy. So I know again from experience that that is the last straw, last resort, and I don't encourage people to do it unless they just absolutely can't take care of their family, can't take care of their other obligations. There is a higher sense of order here, and that's why the bankruptcy rules were created. You know, not for just to let people run up bills and just say, oh, the heck with it, I'll just walk away from it. No, it's for good, honest, serious, legitimate people who find themselves in a place they never would have imagined.
Sure. And you know, the thing that you just hit on there that people don't realize is that when you start believing that it'll never happen to you, that's when it happens to you.
Oh, and right now, Bert, it's happening to people who have never, ever imagined it could happen to them. See, in the old days, a few years ago, we used to think that people with credit card problems and the people who would think about bankruptcy, well, those are, you know, we would kind of put them in that, well, they must be lazy or they must not have gotten a good education or they probably didn't work very hard. And we kind of put them all in a little category, rightly or wrongly. That's kind of the way we do things. But this time around, in this great recession we're in right now, there are people who did it by the rules. They went to school, they studied hard, they got good grades, they went and got a job, they showed up for work every single day of their life, they went and bought a house with a white picket fence, they married the girl next door, they followed every single rule to follow the American dream, and it turned out that maybe some of that wasn't as true as they told us. And now these are people who have never failed before, have never had difficulties before, and now they're unemployed and not able to pay their bills.
You know, something that you just brought up, I think that this generation is one of those generations that hasn't been tested. This economy is their first test.
It is indeed, and I feel so bad for the people going through what they're going through right now. Now, a guy like me, I'm 61 years old, and I have failed and succeeded and failed and succeeded and failed and succeeded, and I have screwed up so many times it's almost pathetic. I'm good at failure. I'm good at screwing up. I'm good at getting knocked down and figuring out how to get back up because I've done it a lot. Now, people who have never had it happen to them, it is the most traumatic thing they may experience in their entire lifetime. And quite frankly, some of them may not know how to deal with it.
Well, it sounds like, you know, what you're saying is failure is a good way to succeed.
It is the only way to succeed. And here's a challenge I give everybody on this call. The Forbes 400 is a list that's published every October by Forbes magazine, so you can go online and get it or wherever you might choose to read it. And read the stories of the people who are on the Forbes 400 list. And except for a few people who inherited some money, and there's usually a handful of them on there, the ones who are self-made, every one of them failed at least once. Some of them failed a half a dozen times. Some of them have filed bankruptcy three or four times in their life. And that's what it almost takes, failure to succeed.
Well, you know, Walt Disney, I believe, filed bankruptcy four
Indeed.
Or five times.
Indeed.
And on top of that, his best friend, which is the famous Art Linkletter, you know, gave up on him, wouldn't lend him the $1,000 he needed to buy what is now Walt Disney in Anaheim.
Mm-hmm. No, but, I mean, the stories are, you know, I mean, they're by the thousands. So, you know, when I started, I'm a student of this industry because I try to share what it is I've learned along the way. The very reason you and I are on this call today is hoping that maybe somebody will hear something that might have some value in their life. Well, I began looking at all of the reasons people succeed and the reasons people fail, and I found an awful lot of correlations between having failed and learning a lesson and then going to a much higher success than you ever would have been able to go to but for the failure.
Absolutely. Bill Bartman, thank you very much. This is Bert Martinez. Thank you.
And Bert, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Bro.
And Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
Ooh. I'm calling the studio, Matthew. You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys, we are back. My next guest, Melissa Ho. I just love that name. Ho, yay, ho. Anyway, I'm just getting goofy here. But Melissa Ho is a criminal defense lawyer. Melissa Ho is a shareholder of the national law firm Posolini. And you can check them out at Posolini.com. Posolini, she's calling us from her Phoenix office. She focuses her legal practice on areas of government investigations and white-collar criminal defense. As of 2 weeks ago, she was honored by the Phoenix Business Journal as a recipient of this year's 40 Under 40 Award. The award recognizes the best and brightest leaders in the Phoenix metro area. I'm excited to have her on the show. Melissa Ho, welcome to Money
for
Lunch.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And let me tell you, Melissa Ho is a great name where you're doing criminal defense.
You know what? You know people don't forget it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. People don't forget it, and it certainly makes your cases memorable, and the court docket's more interesting when you're announced.
All right. Well, let's talk about this because, you know, there's constant stuff in the news and the media about our government, you know, maybe overstepping their bounds. You know, obviously recently with the the NSA phone taps or whatever they're called. You know, what exactly is a government investigation? I mean, versus, I guess, just your basic, I guess, police investigation. Are they very analogous? Basically, the same thing.
You know, they are analogous. I look at a government investigation as anyone, any outside entity who can gather information that can be then used against you, either in a civil context or a criminal context. It always starts off civil, and then when things get serious, it can easily turn criminal. And people always forget that a government investigation doesn't have to be the cops knocking on your door. It can start off from a letter from the IRS, you know, a tax audit, or a letter from the Corporation Commission saying, you know, we're not sure about your filing status. And from there, whomever is on the other side looking at the documents, they can get their interest piqued. And then what happens is they ask for more and more information, and before you know it, you're embroiled in a full-on criminal investigation.
You know what, and I'm glad you brought it up that way, because a lot of people are not aware that in most cases, especially when you're dealing with, like you mentioned, the Arizona Corporation Commission or some other entity of the government, that it does start, you know, with a, you know, we call it a civil letter-writing type of investigation. I had a client of mine several years ago that was involved in this thing called like a civil investigative demand. He had received this letter, and you know, he considers himself a very honest individual, and always, you know, always strives to do what's right, and he's involved in multiple charities and just a very pleasant, honest person. And so when he contacted me about this, the first thing I told him to do, I said, you know, get an attorney now. And he said, "No, I'm not doing anything wrong. I have nothing to be afraid of. I don't care if they look at my books." I said, "They're not looking at your books to find you innocent. You know, they're looking at your books as a way of convicting you. Am I right in that thinking?"
Well, you know, this is how I put it for most people. Oftentimes people will ask me, are cops honest? And I will tell them, it's not that cops are dishonest. It's the fact that they are in the business of getting a conviction. So think of it that way. They've got their own prejudices and their own agendas. And when it comes to civil demand letters and investigatory agencies, I mean, they are looking to see something. And if they clear you, guess what? They'll never tell you you're clear. Now, if they are interested in something, before you know it, you've put yourself in a position where you've now opened up all of your books and probably shown them something that they hadn't even thought about. So your advice to you know, your friend and client to get an attorney was actually very sound advice. You know, I'm at a law firm. Polsinelli is, you know, national. We've got close to 700 attorneys. We're primarily a business law firm. And our white-collar criminal group is small, but what we do is we work proactively with our business lawyers to really protect what you guys have in the beginning. Because oftentimes, by the time you've gotten a government agency interested in you, it's going to be a lot of heartburn and money to kind of wade through. It's much better just to know in advance, are you in a high-risk type of business? You know, have you had any recent contact with law enforcement that you should be concerned about, and kind of get out in front of the problem?
Right. You know what, and here's the rest of that story. So my friend slash client there cooperated completely and turned over everything they asked for, and this went on for like a year, and then they finally, you know, sued him, I guess. It was all civil, and I forgot what the little hook it was that they tried to hang their prosecution on, for lack of better terms, or their civil demand, civil suit on. Because my client wanted to resolve this, he offered them $100,000 settlement, because he realized that, you know, if I get an attorney, it's gonna, you know, this could go on forever and blah blah blah. So the prosecutor at the Attorney General's office declined the $100,000. This went on for approximately 3.5 years. He burned through literally $250,000 in attorney's fees, only to at the very end pay $100,000 settlement which is what he offered to begin with. Now, the attorney general's attorney, the person involved, was reprimanded. But as you mentioned earlier, you know, it was done secretly and it wasn't done in any kind of courtroom or anything like that. My point being to all this is that if he would have gotten an attorney like yourself in the very beginning, it probably would have never gotten this far. And
well,
he would have saved himself,
hope.
Like you said, yeah, heartburn and money. Let me ask you this. Now, in a case like this, when somebody sends you a civil demand notice, investigative notice or demand, whatever it's called, can you as an attorney say, hey, I'm the attorney, I'm representing XYZ company, and, you know, before we answer this letter, we want more information? I mean, as an attorney, what can you do when somebody gets one of these civil investigative demands?
Well, absolutely. It's regardless if it's an investigative demand, a subpoena for documents, just a request for documents, once you have an attorney, presumably the attorney is going to do everything they can to make the request less cumbersome for you. So my job is to talk to whomever issued the request and say, look, what is it that you're actually looking for, and see if they will give me any information. Oftentimes, if it's a grand jury subpoena, they're not going to tell me anything. They're going to say, hey, look, you know, we've got a grand jury subpoena, you're just going to have to do this. But if it's any sort of other type of subpoena or investigative demand, you can oftentimes talk to them to narrow the scope, because what they like to do is say, give me any and all of your records from today to, from the time you started your business. We want 15 years of records for all of your employees, for every single one of your email accounts. Oftentimes things that you don't even have, because it doesn't cost them any money, but it will cost you as the person who has to comply with this request, a lot of money. So what I try to do is both narrow it down so that we minimize the exposure, but also we try to save some costs, because even asking your bank for bank records can cost you per page sometimes.
Right. and we see this all the time, and it's amazing to me, Melissa, how we as a society don't learn this lesson, and that is we see people who are truly innocent, people who are good citizens, who get caught up in this government net, and it, you know, just like my example, they take years and thousands of dollars to unwind themselves out of it, and we see this really on a pretty regular basis. Why do you think that our society is so slow to learn this lesson that, you know, you really need to get an attorney usually sooner than later?
Well, you mentioned it earlier. The natural tendency is to say, I've done nothing wrong. And we all want to believe that in the end, because we live in a great country, that our mere innocence is enough, and that will, win the day. The reality, though, unfortunately, is that even though in a criminal sense, you have to be proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, to exonerate yourself and to, show a government agency that you haven't done anything wrong, you have to be proactive. You just cannot be on the defensive all the time. And people, we want to cooperate. They don't feel as if they need an attorney. They feel either that they are competent enough or smart enough to handle it on their own. It's not about competency. It's not about smart. It's about whether or not you're trained to deal with an investigator, and unless you're a criminal defense lawyer, I would presume that is not what you do day in and day out. So your mind view is very different. Even when I deal with my business colleagues, their reaction is to cooperate immediately. And as a defense attorney, I say, well, let's hold on here. Let's cooperate where it makes sense, and then with the rest of it, I don't need to make the prosecution's job easier. That's not my job. My job is to hold them to their burden of proof. You're accusing my client of something, then prove it.
Right. You know, it's funny because people always like to hear what's the – I don't know if it's an adage or a constitutional line. You tell me. But, it's you're innocent until proven guilty. And that's true, but what people forget is that the emphasis is proven guilty. Their job, as you said, they're in the business of proving you guilty. That's what they do. And I like the fact that you phrase it like that, because it's not about them being right or wrong or dishonest. That's their mindset. When they're talking to you, they're looking at how can they prove their case, and that's it.
Well, and I'll tell you, I started my career as a prosecutor, so I've been on the other side, and I've seen the pressures on prosecutors also. Can I say that every prosecutor does the right thing? No. But I can say for the most part, the prosecutors I've dealt with and I work with day-to-day are honest, ethical people.
Sure.
But what they are facing is they've got huge caseloads. I mean, you look at Maricopa County, and we've got, I want to say, we've been told the fourth highest filings in the nation. I mean, just huge
wow.
filings and a tremendous tax on the system. And the only way to get through cases is you have to do them quickly. And how do you do things quickly? By formula. So you cannot treat people as individuals. Now, that is a scary thought if you're the individual in the system, right? I mean, if you're the prosecutor,
right.
you're just trying to get things off your desk. But if you're the individual, there's nothing scarier than being thought of as just a number. This is a crime, and they look at a formula to decide your fate.
Right, right. You know what? And let me ask you about this, because this is when it really, I think for a lot of people, you know, it ramps up the pressure or the stress, and that is when the media gets involved. You know, how do you handle, what do you suggest your clients to do when the media gets involved?
More and more, I think people need to be savvy enough to recognize that the media can either make you or break you. If it's a business
right.
entity, certainly your reputation is on the line. If you are an individual, Facebook, Twitter, whatever's out there is in the public sphere, certainly if you do it yourself, it can be construed as an admission. If someone else
right.
says it about you, it could possibly be admitted. It depends on the circumstances. But the biggest mistake people make if they find themselves in a high-profile situation is they either don't have a media plan or they have a poor one. And you know, here's an example I give. Say you are in a what I consider a more high-risk industry. Say you're in public education, okay, and there's
okay.
an allegation of misconduct at the school. It could be any sort of misconduct. There's always
right.
some story of abuse. And oftentimes it's not the teacher themselves. It could be someone the school district hired, you know, the local news reports on it. You get parents upset. You have your own teachers worried about what's going on at the school. You have administrators. You have all of these different interest groups who are vying for information, and they have not heard anything from the institution itself. They're relying only on outside media sources. That's not a good situation to be in. You want to be able to have an effective media plan that ensures that you're not jeopardizing whatever your position is, but that also reassures your employees that their jobs are okay, that reassures the parents that their, you know, students are safe, and so on and so forth. I mean, these are kind of the steps that a lot of businesses forget to take into account.
Right, right. You know, and it's interesting that you bring this up, because you're right. We as a society get so much information and misinformation via Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. And it seems like now everybody really needs to have some kind of, you know, communication strategy to deal with this, because, you know, sooner or later it seems to leak out, right? I mean, it's if you want something, if you want a secret kept, you certainly can't really nowadays tell anybody, because sooner or later it leaks out. Somebody's going to talk about it someplace, and it all of a sudden makes your situation much worse.
Absolutely. And what I have been counseling a lot of my clients to do is to have contingency plans. Much as we plan for, you know, like wills and estates, and we plan for life insurance, things like that, people need to plan for emergency situations such as what I call a catastrophic trigger. You get an accusation of wrongdoing.
Right.
What do you do
right.
if it hits the media? Who do your employees contact? Do they even know who to contact? What is your response? Do you have a lawyer that's already retained, or do you have a list of lawyers that you need? The first 48 hours of any triggering event are crucial. how you respond to you know, the government knocking on your door, or you know, a letter received, or you know, simply even an erroneous media report. Those first 48 hours will set the tone for the next, you know, probably 6 months.
Right, and again, if it's we call it maybe a civil demand, maybe that's not public record yet. But certainly, if it's a case that is been filed with the court and is being prosecuted, that is public, and that is how a lot of the media get their information. They just go down to the courthouse and see if they recognize any of the names on the docket, and then boom, it hits the media. And so,
well,
you're right. You have to be ready. Go ahead.
You have to be ready, and also what I was going to say is, what's interesting is you will see these government agencies, you know, picking high-profile cases, and then they advertise it themselves as a press release. So you'll see the Attorney General's office. You'll see that my favorite are the Securities and Exchange Commission or the Department of Justice. You know, because especially after, you know, the whole Bernie Madoff and Enron and all of that, anytime they have a big white-collar case, a big fraud case that they're even investigating, they put it up on their website, and they're hoping that the local media outlets will pick it up because it shows that their agency is doing something. You know, so you have to remember that they've got certainly an incentive to trumpet, you know, their investigations, and you don't want to be the one who kind of gets wrapped up in that.
Yep, yep. You know what? Great talking with you. I'd love to have you back, Melissa Ho. Guys, if you have questions, if you want to be prepared, if you just want to talk to Melissa, you can check her out at Posolini Law Firm. That's Posolini.com. It's PosolineLLI.com. Melissa, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Guys, we're off and running. Great stuff there by Melissa Ho. And just be prepared. Just because you're innocent doesn't mean they're going to leave you alone. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then when we come back, Brandon Buck, also an attorney, right after this commercial break.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Caller Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
Hey, guys. We are back. You know, it's important as the host of the show to be unmuted on a timely basis, just throwing that out there. Anyway, we're going to continue with some legal suggestions. I don't know if it's necessarily advice, but anyway, bottom line is you guys will get it. My next guest, Brandon Buck, business litigation attorney. Brandon Buck is founding partner of the firm of Badham and Buck, LLC, which was formed in January of 2008. Brandon has a civil litigation trial practice focusing on business and commercial disputes. Before starting Badham and Buck, Brandon spent 10 years at the Maynard Cooper Gale, one of the largest firms in the state of Alabama. Brandon has been an active member of the Alabama State Bar. He currently serves as commissioner of the State Bar of the State Bar Board of Bar Commissioners. Man, say that three times fast. He served as president of the Young Lawyers Section of the Alabama State Bar. Brandon has also represented the Alabama Bar as a delegate to the American Bar Association House of Delegates for several years. Brandon was also selected as top 40 under 40 by the Brigham Business Journal in 2011. Brandon Buck, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to be on.
All right, man. Well, let's talk about this. You know, what are some of the types of claims that you handle?
Sure. Well, I, along with my firm, do a lot of handle a lot of litigation matters for businesses, and we see claims, whether it be lawsuits in a courtroom or before a private arbitrator, running the gamut in terms of subject matter. But the claims often take the form of a breach of contract where there's a contractual relationship between the parties. Oftentimes we're seeing claims relating to violation of intellectual property rights, copyright, trademark, that kind of thing, misappropriation of trade secrets, interference with business or contractual relations. Sometimes there's unfair competition type claims under the Lanham Act in the U.S. Code. And then you have some garden variety fraud claims that just arise out of the ordinary course of business relationships that one business might have with another.
Gotcha, gotcha. Let me ask you this, because I know that at least in recent years, it's probably been, I know more than 10, but it seems like a lot of contracts have this thing where people are going to agree to go to arbitration prior to going to court. As an attorney, have you found this arbitration clause helpful, hurtful, worthless, worthwhile? What's your take on it?
You know, that's a really great question, because the perception of arbitration, I believe, is changing. It's changed over the last decade or so. You know, originally, particularly from the consumer standpoint, arbitration was much aboard, and people were trying to do everything they could to get out of an arbitration clause that might be found in a contract. That's changing, though. You know, the playing field has been leveled to some degree in arbitration, and in particular in a business-to-business type dispute, arbitration can be a good thing, because there's some real differences in being before an arbitrator in a private arbitration forum as opposed to being, you know, in the courthouse that you might find yourself in because of where one business or another is located, or a courthouse that a contract might specify.
Gotcha, gotcha. Now, do you yourself prefer arbitration over straight court, or to you it doesn't matter?
Well, you know, it depends on the case. Some of the advantages of arbitration are that oftentimes it's quicker than being in the public, you know, courthouse system. The parties have some role, generally speaking, in selecting who will serve as the arbitrator or arbitrators. One thing that is a big issue with arbitration is that there are very, very limited grounds for appeal. So you go before a private arbitrator or perhaps a panel of three arbitrators. You try your case. It happens more quickly generally than in a courthouse. And you get a ruling by the arbitration panel, and generally that's it. You're stuck with it. There are very, very limited bases to pursue an appeal or get that award overturned, good or bad, fair or unfair. It's sort of once you sign up for it, you're stuck with it. But that
right.
can be a good thing in certain instances, and it draws disputes to a close more quickly, but it also creates a little bit more risk at times, and sometimes there's not the checks and balances that you find in the public court system.
Now, let me ask you this, and I know that this is going to be kind of, counterintuitive, but I want to ask you this because you've been doing this for a while. Do you ever have a client in front of you where you look at the case and you say, you know, Bob, I can take your case on, it's going to cost you a bunch of money, and at the end, you're not going to be much better off than you are right now. I suggest that you just cut your losses and run, because filing a lawsuit is really not going to get you the justice that you're looking for.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a consideration that we undertake along with our clients every time we meet with a potential client about a prospective case. And, you know, there's different things that go into that analysis. I mean, if the case is one where the client is able and willing to pay an hourly fee to pursue the claim, whether it's in arbitration or in court, the client certainly needs to take a hard look at the merits of the case, the potential damages that might be recoverable, assuming the client's obviously on the plaintiff's side, is the party that's filing the claim. And you've got to perform an economic analysis and an analysis of the merits of the case and whether you think the case is worth
putting that money into. Now, the equation changes from the client's perspective if you've got a lawyer who you think is capable, who is willing to take on the case on a contingency fee basis. And
right.
Generally what happens there is you know, the lawyer is only going to get paid if there's a recovery in the case, and the lawyer, generally speaking, may be willing to take on the expenses of, associated with the litigation. And so then that puts the lawyer or the law firm more at risk, and the economic analysis changes for the client, but it obviously puts that burden more directly on the law firm. And we handle both. My firm handles cases in both scenarios under both types of fee arrangements. And we spend a lot of time analyzing cases to try to determine whether it's worth the time and the money for the client and the law firm. And oftentimes
gotcha.
It's not. Oftentimes it's
you know,
not.
And something that you kind of alluded to just a little bit, you know, when we were talking about arbitration versus going to court, and you said, there was something about, you know, sometimes arbitration is better than going to a specific court that the contract states. Have you found that, you know, even though the law is black and white in most cases, that really the law comes down to however the judge feels that day? I mean, that's sometimes I've seen some rulings that, you know, that either this judge got paid off, he wasn't listening, or, you know, maybe he doesn't like the one of the parties in the lawsuit or something. Do you get that sense that sometimes the judge just, you know, makes a ruling based on, I don't know, how they feel?
Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt that there are humans involved in the legal system, whether you're in court or you're in an arbitration. And so there's going to be every judge and every juror is going to approach a case and the facts and the parties that are involved in that case with their own perceptions and their own life experiences, and that's going to influence decisions. There's no doubt about it. My experience, though, has been that while there are sometimes quirky and oddball rulings that occur that at least in the courthouses that I've been in, and that's been throughout the Southeast and in as far west as California, as far north as Boston, that most of these judges are trying to do the right thing.
Sure.
And the law, you know, the there's an interaction between the law and the facts of any given case. And the facts sometimes obscure the clarity of the law, and it makes decisions more subjective than one might think.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, let me ask you this. What motivated you to go into this area of law?
Well, you know, I was at a firm for years, for about 10 years, where my practice just sort of naturally transitioned into commercial litigation. But what I was really drawn to and what our practice focuses on now is representing businesses, large and small, who find themselves in need of filing a case, who find themselves feeling as though they've been done wrong in some context or another, and who feel like they need to assert their rights, their legal rights. And it's interesting because a lot of times our clients – who we're representing are usually on the other side of the V, as we say in the litigation world, meaning that they're more often than not the ones getting sued. But
right.
On occasion, they'll find themselves in need of filing a lawsuit for some reason or another. And I was drawn to the opportunity to really help people who are in a bind and help businesses that are in a bind. And oftentimes, the cases we take on are sort of bet the company type cases where a company has set off into a new important venture for the company, and it's gone bad, and it's put the entire business at risk. And so you know sometimes you're holding someone's or a small businessman's or woman's livelihood kind of in your hands in terms of how that case may turn out. And that's exciting. It also, you know, makes me feel as though I'm have a small hand in trying to help people.
Sure, sure, absolutely. Brandon Buck, we're out of time, guys. If you have questions about your business, possibly a question about a lawsuit, check out Badham & Buck. That's Badham, Buck, BUCK.com. Brandon Buck, again, thanks for stopping by and sharing.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You bet. Guys, we are off and running. When we come back, Rachel Schuyler, I believe that's how you pronounce it, she is the founder and CEO of a kind of an interesting business called The List, right after this quick commercial break.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick. Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, guys, we are back. This is going to be an interesting segment. I'm looking forward to this segment, especially I think that for the female entrepreneurs, managers, founders out there, you want to stay tuned and really listen to this. My next guest, Rachel Schuyler, is a writer and social entrepreneur based in New York City whose single-minded focus is promoting fantastic women everywhere. She started Change the Ratio to increase the spotlight on women in tech and new media and followed up with her new venture, The List, which she calls a visibility platform for awesome. Gosh, I just love that. A visibility platform for awesome. And the website, it's theli.st. That's theli.st. And I think you just pronounce it The List. You just got to remember that. Either way, Rachel Schuyler, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So it's pronounced The List, correct?
It is. It's really meant to be easy, but the placement of the dot in our URL sometimes makes it a little bit more challenging. But it's just The List. If you're confused, just find us on Twitter at The List.
All right. You know what? I love what you're doing here. I love a visibility platform for awesome. I mean,
thank
tell
you.
Me about that. I love that. What is this platform for awesome?
So we were deliberately vague / expansive in that because our visibility platform is far-reaching. So we provide visibility in a number of ways. First and foremost, our membership network. We have a membership network of 500 amazing sort of influential, highly accomplished, far-flung women in business and basically across any industry that you would want to participate in. It's centralized in media and tech, but there's also a number of people in the political sphere, in the creative sphere, in big business, that sort of thing. And so each of them, the combined reach of these women is in our social platforms is in the millions. And so that's the first link is
right.
A visibility magnifier that way. But we've recently launched a newsletter, which is it's thrice weekly, just because we like to say the word thrice. No one uses it, and it's really good work.
You're right. It's the word thrice is just not used enough.
Right. I mean, we're bringing it back. We're bringing it back. And our newsletter aims to invert the standard media defaults that tend to be by men, for men, about men. And
right.
That's just a generalization. I'm not calling anybody particularly into question, but it's just that's what you tend to see. And if you know, look no further than the lineup of the Sunday shows. And so it's a general interest newsletter, but those defaults are inverted. So you are more likely, when you click on a link, to see that it's by a woman or it deals with things that are you know, art created by a woman, media created by a woman. Just it generally inverts those defaults. And in a way that is very safe. You know, it's very safe for men. It's safe space.
Right.
We like to say that we're 100% dude safe, just not 100% dude centric.
So, I love it. Well, you know, I tell you what would be interesting to do. I want you to, and again, you don't have to answer it now, but you can think about this. You know, it would be great to be able to spotlight some of the members of your organization, and so we can bring them on the show, talk about their business and what they're doing, and again, you know, maybe extend your platform for awesome just a little bit. So if you know, so maybe again, we can have some of your members, if you would like to invite them and come on the show, and we can talk.
Yeah, I don't have to think about that. That's fantastic. I can, you know, you need an awesome woman. I got awesome woman.
All right. Well, let's talk about this a little bit more because I'm intrigued. I mean, here you are. You're formerly a founding editor at Huffington Post and Mediaite, and you went from directing coverage to now you become this woman, this advocate for women. How did you make that transition? What was the motivation for the transition as well?
So I was a founding media editor at the Huffington Post. I was there very early on. I was a founder of Eat the Press, which was the first standalone vertical. The Huffington Post now is, you know, it covers every section under the sun, but mine was the prototype. And so I was I was covering media there essentially, and then went on to found Mediaite. So my life was media and media coverage basically for 5 years. And when you are covering media, that means that you are seeing firsthand the inequalities of who gets media, the distribution of media, and how the media tends to treat certain subjects. And this is what I mentioned earlier, which is that the defaults tended to be, you know, you'd see all these power lists and these lists of up-and-comers or 35 or under 35 or top influencers or whatnot. Inevitably, there would just be like this sea of dudes, and usually white dudes. And so you start to notice that. And it just got, you know, more and more frustrating and more difficult to ignore. And then when I started doing work in the tech industry, which sort of pats itself on the back about being such a meritocracy, I saw these paradigms repeating again. And I just wanted to get out front of the problem, frankly, and say, okay, now that we've identified that this happens, that this is the default, we can't just do nothing because that just perpetuates the status quo. So it went from being something that I wrote about to something that I tried to change. And a woman that I had worked with throughout my media career, who was one of my co-founding editors at Mediaite, is now my co-founder, Gwyneth McNichol. And so together we are very used to pushing back at this and just decided that it was, you know, worth taking on full time.
Absolutely. You know what, and you know, the way I was enlightened to this this ratio, and I think most people, at least most men, probably don't snap to this until you have daughters of your own. And you know, I've seen it even at school. We had a situation on the bus where, you know, I have three daughters and two boys.
Wow.
And so you know, we do quite a bit to make sure that our girls are on the same platform as, you know, any of our boys or anything like that, and that they see themselves as equals. And so what was interesting is that we had this incident on the bus where one of my girls stood up to a bully on the bus because he was picking on another girl. And my daughter, you know, in order to protect this other girl, swung and hit this boy with her backpack.
Whoa.
Which I'm thinking, isn't that a good thing? You are standing up for somebody else who is bigger. First of all, this guy is like a foot taller than anybody than my girl or the other girl that she was protecting, and he's a known bully. Anyway, so the way we found out about it, of course, is that the bus driver told the principal, who told us, and so my daughter was reprimanded, and I'm thinking, are you nuts? Are you kidding me? I mean, first of all, she did a really good thing. That's number one. Number two, and I said this to the principal, I said, I don't think this would have been happening if it would have been a male student. I mean, you know, if anything, we have to really, as a society, try to elevate our girls so they see themselves as equals and not anything less than. And again, I didn't have this epiphany until I started having daughters, and you start realizing that this inequality is massive. I mean, you see it, like I said, in our schools, you see it in our business, you see it everywhere, and it's amazing that it still goes on with today's, quote, modern society.
Well, you know, I, without knowing the particulars of the situation, I love the fact that your daughter, you know, stood up to a bully, stood up for her friend. Sort of, you know, and in the larger sphere, that's basically called push. That's pushing against, you know, the status quo, and scared to take a stand, and it calls attention to you, and you know, and it's often negative attention. While you know, so I don't often take my purse and smack at people who are annoying me, although sometimes I might be tempted. But we try to keep at the list. We try to keep our broad sides of the verbal and logical variety. But I do, you know, you can't really argue with the efficacy of it sometimes. there's a lot of, you know, one of the members of the list is a woman by the name of Rachel Simmons, who's done an unbelievable amount of research on how young girls are socialized and sort of the tacit social messages they get. Really simple things like, you know, a girl who calls out an answer in class is more likely to get reprimanded for calling out than a boy. A boy who shouts out his answer will probably just get, oh, you know, great answer, Billy, or whatnot. As girls get older through public school and then middle school, they start to like feel the sting of attention in a much more negative way than boys do, as though, you know, to get attention, to call attention to oneself is perceived more negatively. She's done really interesting research. So, you know, there's no question that girls are socialized very differently from boys, right down to sort of the onesies that they get when they're just born. You know, Jennifer Siebel Newsom, in her TED Talk, she was a documentarian who made Misrepresentation. She talked about how when she gave birth to a boy, she got little onesies that said, you know, future president. And when she had a girl, she got little, you know, little onesies in pink that said, like, mommy's girl, or I'm so pretty. so it starts early, and we have to be on guard.
Yeah, we really do. And again, you don't realize this until you either, I mean, unless you're a female, or until you start having daughters, then you realize, you know, things are just a little bit out of whack. And by when I say a little bit, I really mean, you know, it's completely out of whack. It's a lot out of whack. And you see it, as you said, from really early on. And and so it is fascinating. And I'm glad that you and your organization is out there to correct this and help us realize the power and gift that women provide in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just a social good. You know, as we like to say, there's a lot of money to be made by taking women seriously. Women are tremendously underserved in that regard, the being taken seriously regard. And, you know, one of the reasons that we changed the ratio as an organization that's not for profit and started the list in a more targeted, specific for-profit way is because we recognize that, you know, there were actual deliverables, actual products that would be eagerly snapped up by women who were seeking to, you know, have information asymmetries corrected, to be spotlighted in the same way as men are, to just be aware of more opportunities and to connect with each other in order to build their own network.
Right, right. You know what, and I would love to bring you back and talk about this market, because I agree with you. There's a huge market there to be served, and unfortunately we're out of time, but I would love to have you come back and talk some more.
Great, I would love to. Thanks so much, and I'll send some fabulous women your way.
All righty. Rachel Sklar, thank you so much. Guys, check her out at thelist.com. Well, it's not thelist.com, it's the... It throws me off. Just check it out, the list. Rachel, thanks again for stopping by.
Thank you.
You bet. Guys, what a great show. Great stuff today. Love all the stuff that's happening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.